This innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. Let me spell out precisely what I mean by that. For the heart of the matter is here, and the root of my dispute with my country. You were born where you were born and faced the future that you faced because you were black, and for no other reason. The limits of your ambition were, thus, expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and as many ways as possible that you were a worthless human being. I know your countrymen do not agree with me about this, and I hear them saying you exaggerate. They do not know Harlem, and I do. So do you. Take no one's word for anything, including mine, but trust your experience. Know whence you came. If you know whence you came, there is really no limit to where you can go.
That's from James Baldwin's letter to his nephew in his revolutionary work, The Fire Next Time. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Born in Harlem in 1924, James Baldwin became an acclaimed novelist, playwright, short story writer, essayist, poet, and activist, known for exploring racial and sexual identity in 20th century America. What is Baldwin's place in African American literature, American literature, and world literature? How are his works indebted to black music? Why did he leave America? What is his legacy? Joining us is Craig Werner, professor of Afro-American Studies at the UW-Madison and author of numerous books, including Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America. Also joining us to read James Baldwin is Jesse Woodard, Jr., graduate of the UW Odyssey Project. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James Baldwin, such a giant figure in African-American literature. If you're thinking of his place as a writer, Craig, where do you see him fitting in?
I think James Baldwin is the prophetic voice of 20th century American fiction. He transcends any kind of limit, the ghetto that sometimes established around African American writers. He ranks with Faulkner, with Hemingway, with John Steinbeck, with Toni Morrison, as one of our greatest necessary voices, somebody who always calls us back to a clear-eyed sense of the realities that we sometimes ignore and calls us to create a future that we have trouble imagining.
And do you see him primarily as an African-American writer or, you know, if you think of the question American literature and also world literature, where does he fit in?
I think Baldwin is a major figure in every one of those traditions. He is most certainly an African-American writer. He draws deeply on the history and the cultural traditions of black America. He knew that. He embraced that. He never for a moment denied who he was or where he came from. At the same time, he speaks of the central issues of American identity. Like Faulkner, for example, he knew that until we came correct on race, we had no real idea of who we were and that our pretensions to democracy, to world leadership, were an ironic farce. And finally, as has become increasingly clear, Baldwin sounds a voice which has echoed throughout the world. He is a key figure amongst what are sometimes called post-colonial intellectuals and writers. Hanif Qureshi comes to mind. The writers who are struggling to free their minds from ways of thinking which they know carry with them the weight of a past they're trying to escape. He's an absolutely crucial figure in all of those traditions.
I know that the titles of many of his books come from music. They're like pieces of songs or echoes of spirituals and so on. Can you talk a bit about what the relationship is between James Baldwin's work and music?
Baldwin grew up with music all around him. As a young man, as a boy growing up in Harlem, he heard the jukeboxes at the corner bars. He heard the blues. He walked by the doors of the clubs where jazz was entering into new phases over the course of his lifetime. And I think most importantly, he heard the music of the black church, particularly the storefront churches, the very poor churches that he grew up in. He was a child evangelist as a teenager. He heard the voices of the saints. His first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, comes from a black sacred song that echoes way back in the tradition. His final novel, Just Above My Head, is taken from a gospel song. His probably finest work, Sonny's Blues, is out of the blues and jazz tradition. The lead character of his searing novel, Another Country, Rufus Scott, is a jazz drummer. And at every step of Baldwin's way, he was carrying that music with him, thinking about it. Part of what's unique about Baldwin's style is the way that he weaves the music deeply, deeply into the texture of each sentences. Sometimes it's clear. In Another Country, there's a sequence where Ida, a black woman who's attempting to make it as a jazz singer, sings Trouble in Mind, a Nina Simone song, and then sings a bit of Just Above My Head. And you can feel that as just the texture of daily life and as a way of processing the world. Let's listen to a little bit of Nina Simone's Trouble in Mind. It's Nina Simone, and she was a singer James Baldwin deeply loved. He wrote about her, honored her, and saw her as a sister in the struggle. And in that, you can hear the echoes of the blues in African-American life. And Baldwin, in a brilliant essay called The Uses of Blues, wrote about what that meant.
And I want to suggest that the acceptance of this anguish one finds in the blues and the expression of it creates also, however odd this may sound, a kind of joy. Now, joy is a real state. It is reality. It has nothing to do with what most people have in mind when they talk of happiness, which is not a real state and does not really exist.
Is he talking about sort of this bittersweet quality that's in the blues?
Yeah. He's talking about the way in which the blues are grounded in suffering, in pain, and in an honest acceptance of that. You can't run away from it. For Baldwin, as he looked out over the United States he was growing up in the 30s and 40s, and then into the 50s as he became a well-known writer, and into the 60s when he became a public figure, he saw a nation that refused to tell the truth about itself. And so he went to the blues for that truth, the fact that you wake up, you feel bad. You don't explain it away. You don't medicate yourself. You deal with it. Ralph Ellison called it fingering the jagged grain of a brutal experience. Baldwin talks about it as taking the anguish. And if you deal with the anguish, you may ultimately, by knowing who you are, by being able to connect with other people really are, by understanding the society you're living in, find a kind of paradoxical joy.
What's important to know about Baldwin's early life in Harlem, his family, some of that anguish or pain that he experienced growing up?
Yeah, Baldwin grew up literally on the streets of Harlem. He did have a home. He was an illegitimate child whose mother then married a man who provided for the family. In a kind of technical sense, he was a good enough father, certainly by the standards of the place and time. But it's clear that he held Baldwin's parentage against him. Baldwin was the oldest of a large family, and the burden of caring for his brothers and sisters fell heavily upon him. He told stories often about stirring the pot on the stove with one hand while taking care of his little brothers and sisters and trying to read. Usually he talks about Charles Dickens. He has a Dickens novel in his hand at that point. And you get the sense of somebody who's baffled by the world, who's burdened by the world, but is determined to make the most of it. He took great solace from the church. He found, as his first novel, Goteld on the Mountain, shows, an incredible energy and a spiritual depth and a sense of community in the church at the same time that it was wrapped up with denials, particularly of his sexual urges. Baldwin would not have used the term homosexual. He didn't use the term gay. He hated all labels for human beings. But he did not deny his sexual attraction for men. And that played out in the church. There's a brilliant scene in his novel, Goteld on the Mountain, where there's a wrestling match between the protagonist and another young man with huge sexual overtones to it. But within the church itself, that, of course, would have been unacceptable at the time. So Baldwin was struggling, and he read always. He read. And he was blessed with some of his teachers. At Frederick Douglass Junior High School, he was taught by the Harlem Renaissance poet, County Cullen, who encouraged him to think of himself as a writer. And he began writing and publishing very young. So there's this tension between the life in Harlem during the Depression, dirt level poor, poor as you can get, and Baldwin was on the lower side of that, not the upper side of that, and the sense of a world of art and culture that could help not quite lift him above it, but let him deal with it in that blues way, find the joy inside the anguish.
Is there a passage from Goteld on the Mountain that we could hear that would give us a sense of his cadences, his voice?
Yeah. In this passage from Goteld on the Mountain, Baldwin, speaking in the voice of an older black woman, describes the connection between the Harlem he was growing up in and the South, where most of his elders were born.
There was not, after all, a great difference between the world of the North and that of the South, which she had fled. There was only this difference. The North promised more. And this similarity, which is promised, it did not give. And what it gave at length and grudgingly with one hand, it took back with the other.
So was Baldwin's family part of the sort of migration north?
Yes. Baldwin's family was part of the Great Migration, the movement of African Americans from the rural South to the urban North. And as that passage suggests, that was North represented kind of a promised land in the minds of those people. But when they arrived there, it didn't offer what had been promised. And you can hear Baldwin's style in that passage, the careful balancing of one image against another image. It's a classical rhetorical style. He knew how to write. He knew how to write very, very well and developed a voice on the page that's, to some extent, the voice, I think, of that childhood preacher.
I've seen Goteld on the Mountain referred to as a semi-autobiographical novel. Is it pretty much Baldwin's own story?
It's a fictional recreation of Baldwin's story. You can't trust it on the details, but in terms of the perspective on the world, it's very much Baldwin's story. There's a beautiful scene where young John Grimes, the protagonist, it happens on his birthday, walks out of the house in Harlem and then walks downtown in New York and walks through some of the richest areas in the world. And that sense of the stark contrast between the world he's living in and the world he's excluded from. It's political. It's a commentary upon segregation, on race in America. But at that stage of his life, Baldwin rarely underlined the political point. He embedded it in the experience of his characters. And part of that experience was that disillusionment, the dream deferred, as Langston Hughes called it, of moving from the South to a North that didn't provide what was offered. There's another passage in Go Tell It on the Mountain, which I think gives a deep sense of how Baldwin dealt with this emotionally, the complexity of his point of view. In this scene, what's happening is John Grimes, the protagonist, has fallen down upon the threshing floor, on the floor of the church that he's in, and he's having a vision that brings him into connection with the long history of African Americans and the people around him.
Then the darkness began to murmur, a terrible sound, and John's ears trembled. This sound had filled John's life, so it now seemed from the moment he had first drawn breath. He had heard it everywhere, in prayer and in daily speech, and wherever the saints were gathered, and in the unbelieving streets. It was in his father's anger and in his mother's calm insistence and the vehement mockery of his aunt. It had rung so oddly in Roy's voice this afternoon. And when Elijah played the piano, it was there. It was in the beat and jangle of Sister McCandless's tambourine. It was the very cadence of her testimony, and invested that testimony with a matchless, unimpeachable authority. Yes, he had heard it all his life, but it was only now that in his ears were open to the sound that came from the darkness, that could only come from the darkness, that yet bore such sure witness to the glory of the light.
That definitely has a biblical cadence, doesn't it?
It does. Baldwin knew the Bible inside and out. The Bible was the source of many of the gospel songs, the images in those songs that he loved, and he just wove them in together into a style that has no peer.
Now, in a work like Notes of a Native Son, he has quite a bit of criticism of Richard Wright's Native Son. What was the relationship between Baldwin and Richard Wright?
Baldwin and Wright had a very complicated relationship. In 1942, Baldwin, having graduated from high school, escaped Harlem. He moved first to Greenwich Village, downtown. He actually had some jobs in New Jersey also, but he got away from Harlem and started connecting with kind of the bohemian art scene, the interracial scene in downtown New York. And then in 1945, he received a grant from Harper's Eugene Saxon Memorial Fund, which allowed him to go to Paris to work on his first novel. And in Paris, he met Richard Wright, who was by far the most prominent African-American writer of the time. Native Son had been a major literary event, Book of the Month Club, main selection, number one bestseller. And Baldwin was, to some extent, awed by the older, more successful man. And Wright, in some ways, took Baldwin under his wing and was useful for Baldwin in his making connections with the intellectual world of Paris, where Wright had been for several years. But Baldwin, who was always honest, wrote an essay called Many Thousands Gone, in which he criticized Wright for simplifying the personality of Bigger Thomas, the protagonist of Native Son. Baldwin thought that it was a serious intellectual discussion. Wright took it as a betrayal, and Wright was angry with Baldwin. And then over the next decade, until Wright's death, they were in a very, very tense kind of a relationship with one another. And the literary world of the time set Baldwin up as an answer to Wright, as his antagonist. And the way that played out was that they said James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, who began publishing at about the same time, represented literary values, whereas Wright was reduced to a political propagandist. It was art versus politics, and Baldwin was cast on the art side of that. It was a role he didn't want, but it was a role he had a great deal of trouble escaping, particularly when he was cast into the forefront of American public life as a spokesman for the civil rights movement in the late 50s and early 60s.
We're going to follow James Baldwin right into that public arena as he takes up the cause of civil rights when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Every artist in America is more or less isolated, more rather than less. And in the case of a black artist, the alienation is doubly dangerous because he's, by definition, removed from white people, and he's alienated from the audience, which can nourish him.
That's James Baldwin speaking in an interview in the 1980s for the American Audio Prose Library. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. With me is Craig Werner and also Jesse Woodard Jr. as the voice of James Baldwin for this hour. And we're talking about 20th century giant of African-American literature, James Baldwin. We looked at his upbringing in Harlem, some of the trouble he had, his indebtedness to black music, his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, his struggles with Richard Wright in Notes of a Native Son and elsewhere. Now let's get James Baldwin out into sort of the public arena and look at the extent to which he got involved with civil rights.
In 1960, Baldwin accepted a journalistic assignment to write an essay, which turned into a series of essays on the civil rights movement. It's important to remember that although our story of the civil rights movement goes Brown versus Board of Education, Montgomery bus boycott, Birmingham, March on Washington, all of these triumphs, the fact is that between about 1957 and 1959 or 1960, the civil rights movement looked like it was dead in the water. Nothing was going on at that point. And it was the emergence of a student-led movement, the sit-ins, the freedom rides, that reinvigorated the movement in 1960 is when that emerged is in a clear way. And Baldwin was fascinated by what was going on. He was afraid of going to the South. The South was associated with slavery, with lynchings, with Jim Crow, and he was very hesitant to go to the South. But he went, and he wrote some incredible pieces of journalism, essays about what was happening in the movement. He was an extremely eloquent speaker at times, and he became gradually a figure who you saw on the 6 o'clock news talking about the movement. He became, and this was a term he absolutely despised, but he became a spokesman. He became one of the official Negroes at the time. When white America wanted to know what black people thought, it was a whole lot easier having one or two people you could go to than having to deal with the reality that there are countless arguments within black America. Point Baldwin made again and again, yet and still he knew something important was happening and he wanted to add his voice and his energy to the struggle. So that in the early 1960s, Baldwin shifted his focus from investigations of what was going on inside the personal lives of his characters. He always knew that that had to do with the public world we were in. And resisting the split between public and private was a good deal of what he was always about. But in the early 60s, the balance shifted towards the public. His novel, Another Country, became a huge bestseller. And an essay he published originally in a magazine, The Fire Next Time, became a touchstone for discussions of the movement and what was going on. Now, the interesting thing about The Fire Next Time is that Baldwin's very careful to ground his political insights in his sense of our collective psychology, of America's evasions and resistances. In this passage, he talks about the foundation of the problem.
All of us know, whether or not we were able to admit it, that mirrors can only lie, that death by drowning is all that awaits one there. It is for this reason that love is so desperately sought and so cunningly avoided. Love takes off the mask that we fear. We cannot live without and know we cannot live within. I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth.
What does he mean by the phrase that mirrors lie?
Baldwin's talking about the way in which America is so caught up in its self-image, in its notion of who it is, looking only at itself, looking only at its own perspective, that it sees nothing beyond. that we sink in to a sense of ourselves. We can't hear. We can't see what's going on around us, which means we can't love. So for Baldwin, politics was grounded in this inability to love, that white people were unable to see past their image of what America was into the reality of what America was. It's death by drowning. It's sinking away, unable to breathe. You're in that air of the suburban tract houses. Baldwin railed against American consumerism, that we look in the TV and we see a fantasy world, an incoherent world. He used that word often, an incoherent world of Coca-Cola and Cadillac was the way he talked about it. Then today that's something different. Today it's sneakers and iPods and whatever the next product they're going to sell us so that we don't have to look at ourselves. So for Baldwin, the civil rights movement was about calling America not only to political justice, but also to moral self-knowledge, to a world in which it would be possible to love.
Isn't it ironic, then, that Baldwin left America? If he was going to spend so much time talking as an American and talking about America, why did he feel he had to go into exile?
Well, I think that part of that is that as long as he was here, he couldn't see anything other than America. I have a daughter currently teaching in Korea, and she wrote a blog spot recently saying that now she understands she's an American. And I think that Baldwin would have understood that. That was what he was calling for and what he needed to do. For one thing, he knew that he would probably have died if he'd stayed in the U.S. He probably would have been killed. He probably would not have played the role which was assigned him. So on one level, he had to leave. But on a larger level, he needed to be able to step back and see America in a much broader picture. He talks about what's happening on the streets of Tehran, which nobody was talking about in the 1960s. Ultimately, he would go into a deeper exile. He would leave Paris, and he would spend much of the last part of his life in Istanbul, in Turkey, and that was to provide yet a broader sense of the American world. And part of it, I think, is honestly that he was always in a restless search for finding love. As he says, he didn't want happiness, that infantile American dream, but he wanted to participate in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. That's what literature was about. That's for Baldwin what the movement was about. Hard to get that into a 30-second soundbite on the 6 o'clock news.
Can you say something about the title of The Fire Next Time?
Yeah, The Fire Next Time, like so many of Baldwin's titles, comes from the gospel tradition. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. It was saying that if we did not come correct with ourselves, if we did not tell the truth, if we did not answer the call of Dr. King and Ella Baker and the students of SNCC and CORE, that we were facing an apocalypse. The essay that became The Fire Next Time was published, I believe it was in December of 1962. In 1963, the streets of America began to burn, and they would burn for the summers of the next 5 or 6 years. And Baldwin would say that on a deeper level, the level where it's about our spirits rather than about the buildings, where it's about our ability to love rather than the corner liquor store, that fire's never gone out.
Let's hear another passage from The Fire Next Time.
And here we are at the center of the Ark, trapped in the gaudiest, most valuable, and most improbable water wheel the world has ever seen. Everything now, we must assume, is in our hands. We have no right to assume otherwise. If we, and now I mean the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of others, do not falter in our duty now. We may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and to achieve our country and change the history of the world. If we do not dare everything, the fulfillment of that prophecy recreated from the Bible in song by a slave is upon us. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time.
And in that, you can hear Baldwin saying that, yes, this is about race. It's about America. But it's not just ending the racial nightmare. It's also achieving our country. That's the goal that was at the center of American literature from Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson through Hemingway and Faulkner. He's very much in the American grain. And it's about changing the history of the world.
What did Baldwin think of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and when their assassinations took place? How did it affect them?
Deeply. It deeply affected him. Baldwin loved and respected both Martin and Malcolm. He saw them as part of the same agenda. He also understood that the student movement, the ordinary people whose lives were on the line, was crucially important. He was hard to pin down to a particular agenda. In The Fire Next Time, he writes about the limitations of Christianity, which was King's foundation. He writes about the limits of Islam, the Nation of Islam specifically, Malcolm's foundation on that, and calls for a kind of love that transcended any particular religious dogma. But he was deeply moved, saddened, devastated by the assassinations.
At the same time, you've got the growing Black Power movement. How did James Baldwin feel about that?
Baldwin was sympathetic with Black Power. He saw Black Power as inevitable in a certain sense, that it was a assertion of a younger generation which was acutely aware of the limitations of their elders, that they were in rebellion against some of the things which Baldwin had clearly written about in his earlier books. And so he looked to Stokely Carmichael particularly as a very powerful figure and as a harbinger of a new world. At the same time, Black Power presented some very real problems to Baldwin. One of those involved its ideological emphasis, that Baldwin was suspicious of all ideologies. He said even the finest theories must be blown apart by the realities of experience. And there were points at which Black Power was rhetorical. It was talking about things that were just out of sync with what was actually being lived in Black America. That played out in part around the legacy of the church, the fact that legacy of the blues, Maulana Karenga, a Black Power spokesman, once said the blues are invalid for they teach acceptance of reality and we have come to change reality. Well, first of all, it's nonsense that that's what the blues are about. But secondly, it meant that Black Power was out of sync with the voices that were structuring the day-by-day life of most of Black America. The rejection of Christianity as a white devil's religion didn't really have much to do with the way most Black women were living in ghettos of America. So Baldwin was acutely aware that the ideology sometimes blinded the Black Power advocates to reality. And then there was the issue of sexuality, that Black Power was in large part an assertion of Black masculinity. Again, Baldwin understood that that was necessary. He understood that Black men had been put in positions where they could not support their families, where their power was denied to them on many, many levels. He saw his father's bitterness. He saw the broken men on the streets around him, and he knew that had to be changed. But the version of masculinity which was being asserted was aggressively heterosexual. It was grounded in American stereotypes of what it meant to be a man. And Baldwin was somebody who, as a homosexual, was often repudiated. Eldridge Cleaver launched a vicious attack on Baldwin in his very popular book, Soul on Ice. And in his book, No Name in the Street, Baldwin struggled to come to terms with that. He tried to accept where it was coming from without accepting the statements that were being made against him, and it was a very anguished time for Baldwin in many, many ways.
We're going to look at Baldwin's legacy and samples from some of his later novels when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
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 Mrs. James Baldwin, and I'm going to read two passages from my novel, Just Above My Head. This is the opening of the novel. The damned blood burst, first through his nostrils, then pounded through the veins in his neck. The scarlet torrent exploded through his mouth. It reached his eyes and blinded him, and brought Arthur down, 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 down. The telephone call did not go into these details, neither did the telegram, urgently demanding my arrival because my brother was dead. The laconic British press merely noted that a nearly forgotten Negro moaner and groaner, that is how the British press described my brother, had been found dead in a men's room in the basement of a London pub. No one told me how he died. The American press noted the passing of an emotion-filled gospel singer, dead at the untidy age of 39.
That was James Baldwin reading from the opening of his novel, Just Above My Head. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Craig Werner, and we also have with us Jesse Woodard, Jr., to read more of Baldwin. Tell us about this novel, Craig, Just Above My Head, and its relationship to that gospel song.
Just Above My Head was Baldwin's last novel and his last major work. I think it's one of the half a dozen or so greatest American novels. That's not a position which is dominant in the literary world, but I'm not the only one who feels that way. Baldwin in the novel does something that's absolutely extraordinary. Writing about the relationship between two brothers, the gospel singer whose death is described in the opening passage and the brother who is describing the death, what Baldwin does is goes back over the course of African-American history, the course of his own literary career, and rethinks everything from a position on the other side of the river in some ways. And Just Above My Head delves into the civil rights movement. It delves into the complications of our sexual and racial identities. And he does it in a way that I think more than any other book that's been written captures the feel and the vision and the emotional complexity of African-American music.
And can you give us some more of a sense of, I guess, what happens in the novel Just Above My Head?
The novel involves the rise of Arthur Montana, the gospel singer, who becomes a major star. But it's really about what makes him who he is. It's about his love relationships with other young African-American men. It's about a tour that the gospel quartet he's singing with as a teenager takes to the South, during which one member of the quartet is presumably killed. We never know what happens to him, which is part of the agony of it, by white supremacists. It's about the relationship between the spiritual and the sexual world, the world of the temple and the street. It's about rape and the recovery from rape. From a women's perspective, it's a book which talks about the core of the blues. What can you do when your humanity has been violated by this? Well, for Baldwin, for the African-American women whose experience had been based on rape for a long, long time by slave masters, by their employers in the South. That was simply a fact of life, and you couldn't let it stop you. You had to move on. And Baldwin is talking about what it takes to find the strength in yourself to love those around you in a world that's trying to reduce you to being a thing. It's about the struggles that we have with our own desires. How do we know what it is to do the right thing? And all of it against the backdrop of this absolutely crucial moment in American history. In this passage from Just Above My Head, Baldwin talks about the mirror that we spoke of earlier. He goes back to that, only now, I think, from a more precise intellectual position.
The power to define the other seals one's definition of oneself. Who then, in such a fearful mathematic, is trapped? Perhaps then, after all, we have no idea what history is, or are in flight from the demon we have summoned. Perhaps history is not to be found in our mirrors, but in our repudiations. Perhaps the other is ourselves. history may be a great deal more than the quicksand which swallows others and which has not yet swallowed us. History may be attempting to vomit us up and spew us out. History may be tired. Death itself, which swallows everyone, is the beginning to be weary of history. In fact, for death has no history. Our history is each other. That is our only guide. One thing is absolutely certain. One can repudiate or despise no one's history without repudiating and despising one's own. Perhaps that is what the gospel singer is singing.
And what does he mean by that? Perhaps that's what the gospel singer is singing.
I think that's the core of what Baldwin was always talking about, that in order to understand ourselves, we have to understand the other, the people we don't like. That one can repudiate or despise no one's history without repudiating and despising one's own. It's reaching out to the least of these. It's the book of Luke. It's the biblical prophets that Baldwin was always circling back to, that we have to find a way to love each other. And we can't do that only when we like each other, that it's not easy, that if we're going to escape this water wheel, if we're going to come to terms with this history which is swallowing us up, we have to find a way to look at it and see something more than death. And the horrible thing for Baldwin when he looked at American history, when he looked at the deaths of the civil rights workers, when he looked at Vietnam, when he looked at the workings of the capitalist system in the Third World, he saw a nation that looked in its mirror and saw freedom, where if you looked around the mirror, what you saw was death.
It seems to me Baldwin was a figure with great courage. If you think of how open he was about writing about sexuality in a novel like Giovanni's Room, or the way he wrote so movingly about a young pregnant mother in If Beale Street Could Talk, it just seems as if he's tackling subjects that were not commonly expressed at the time and doing so in a very honest voice.
Baldwin was a courageous man, a courageous writer, and honesty was at the core of his goal. At the end of the autobiographical notes, which opened his book Notes of a Native Son, he wrote, looking back at Ernest Hemingway as a kind of a role model, he wrote, "I want to be an honest man and a good writer." That was the core of what Baldwin was about. And for him, that meant not looking away from anything. The problems in the black community, and If Beale Street Could Talk, the realities of our sexual incoherence, the lies we tell ourselves, the evasions we think we're going to get away with, but never really do. That was the core of what it was all about.
For most people, if they're going to encounter Baldwin, it's often in an anthology, and the one story that seems to get reproduced more than any other is Sonny's Blues. Can you talk about that, and including just, again, his uses of the blues?
Sure. For a change, the people who choose the official book, official story by a writer, get it right with Baldwin. If you're going to read one piece of Baldwin, Sonny's Blues is clearly the place to start. After that, go to Another Country and Just Above My Head. But in Sonny's Blues, he takes the situation of Just Above My Head, two brothers, one a musician, one not, and reworks it in a short, very, very clear form. The narrator is a math teacher, somebody who is upwardly mobile, a black man who's moved to the projects, which at that time were a sign of hope. As he said, it didn't take long for that to change. His brother is a jazz musician, and the narrator thinks he's going to live the standard American life, thinks he's going to escape into the mainstream. The musician brother, Sonny, knows better. In this passage, he's talking to the narrator about what drove him to heroin addiction and landed him in jail.
"It's terrible sometimes inside. That's what's the trouble. You walk these streets black and funky and cold, and there's not really a living ass to talk to, and there's nothing shaking, and there's no way of getting it out. That storm inside. You can't talk it, and you can't make love with it. And when you finally try to get with it and play it, you realize nobody's listening. So you've got to listen. You've got to find a way to listen."
So that's the voice of Sonny, the brother?
Yeah, that's the voice of the jazz man there, deeply grounded in the African-American tradition, which also was the foundation of Baldwin's writing, that you can see Baldwin in this piece meditating on his own art. There's another passage in which he describes the streets he's walking on.
All that hatred down there, all that hatred and misery and love, it's wonder it doesn't blow the avenue apart.
The hatred and the misery and the love, that's what Baldwin was dealing with. And he was hoping that the country would find a way not to blow itself apart. And for him, that came down to the call of the blues. And in the final scene of Sonny's Blues, Baldwin provides what I think is the most stirring picture of black music, what's going on inside the musician, inside the group, and between the artist and the audience. It's a model of what Baldwin wanted his relationship with us to be. The song that the group is playing is a standard called Am I Blue? Let's listen to just a bit of that from Billie Holiday so you can have it in your mind.
How is a song like that then somehow behind what happens in Sonny's Blues?
Well, in the final scene of Sonny's Blues, Sonny, the pianist returning to the stage after addiction, after jail, after finding himself on the verge of the abyss, begins to rediscover his voice, to find ways to tell the truth. Early in the set, there's a beautiful passage in which Baldwin describes the presence of a bass player named Creole and the way that his response urges Sonny on.
Then Creole stepped forward to remind them that what they were playing was the blues. It hit something in all of them. He hit something in me, myself, and the music tightened and deepened. Apprehension began to beat the air. Creole began to tell us what the blues were all about. They were not about anything very new. He and his boys up there were keeping it new at the risk of ruin, destruction, madness, and death in order to find new ways to make us listen. For while the tale of how we suffer and how we were delighted and how we may triumph is never new, it always must be heard. There isn't any other tale to tell. It's the only light we've got in all this darkness.
Finding new ways to make us listen. That was the core of what Baldwin's life and work were about. You couldn't just say the same thing time and time again. The world had changed. People had changed. When Baldwin was born, segregation was the law of the land. By the time he wrote Sonny's Blues, Montgomery was happening. Brown versus Board of Education had been passed by the Supreme Court. By the time he wrote Just Above My Head, civil rights and black power had risen and were beginning to fall. And at every step of the way, for Baldwin, what black music told us, what he learned, modeled in his speeches, in his essays, and his novels, was that that was what we had to do, and that we have to listen. For the African-American artist. And this is one of its gifts to the world. The art is not just in what you write. It's in the impact it has on the people around you. And as Baldwin continued in Sonny's Blues, he describes how that feels. He describes how that makes the narrator feel.
And this tale, according to that face, that body, those strong hands on those strings, has another aspect in every country, a new depth in every generation. Listen, Creole seemed to be saying, listen. Now these are Sonny's Blues. He made the little black man on the drums know it, and the bright brown man on the horn. Creole wasn't trying any longer to get Sonny in the water. He was wishing him Godspeed. Then he stepped back very slowly, filling the air with the immense suggestion that Sonny speak for himself.
And for Baldwin, speaking for yourself was something that Americans very, very rarely did. That he listened to the world around him and he heard people saying what the TV, the radio, the politicians told them to say, thinking what they were told to think. He would have hated the world of Fox News and blogs. It would have driven him absolutely insane. And the struggle, the imperative for Baldwin was that we find our own voices, tell the truth about who we are, so that we have at least a chance of telling the truth about the larger world. And that, for Baldwin, was what freedom was all about. The end of Sonny's Blues speaks to that and, again, issues a call that's as meaningful today as it was in 1956.
Then they all gathered around Sonny, and Sonny played. Every now and again, one of them seemed to say amen. Sonny's fingers filled the air with life, his life, but that life contained so many others. And Sonny went all the way back. He really began with the spare, flat statement of the opening phrase of the song. Then he began to make it his. It was very beautiful because he wasn't hurried, and it was no longer a lament. I seemed to hear with what burning he had made it his, with what burning we had yet to make it ours, how we could cease lamenting. Freedom lurked around us, and I understood.